Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
What is that mug behind you? What is that? What?
This?
Yeah.
This is what is Blooper that? Brave. This is the mascot for the Braves, Blooper Brave.
Why do you have that?
Because, one, I lived in Atlanta.
I didn't know that.
I lived in Atlanta for a year working. Blooper's like one of my favorite mascots. It's just a silly Muppety looking dude. And I got a cut. This is Blooper Brave. How do you not
know
that?
Okay. All right. I did not know that. That's interesting.
And
okay.
As you can tell, I keep only my fanciest items.
Just like, what the fuck is that thing? Oh, that's awesome.
And okay. Don't worry. I'm learning things about you.
Oh, my God. You're a cartoon character.
Sure am. Any hoozle boozles. We are back. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Party Line Podcast. We just saw that Virginia Supreme Court has struck down the recently passed in April redistricting that took away all but one Republican seat in the state. Now, remember that referendum, that, you know, amendment to the Constitution for a short-term fix for them to be able to do this only passed with like 51% of the vote. So it wasn't a huge overwhelming mandate. But I think as we see these redistricting fights continue across the country, we're going to see them continued litigated all the way up to the Supreme Court. Eventually, it's going to get there. If that's the Virginia case or any of the other states that have done this, Texas, California, anybody, you can name a few, that this will continue to go on. So the question is, when are we going to know what the maps are for November?
Right, which is an absurd question to have to ask in May, as we feel. You know, I mean, we're in a situation now where I wonder if the court might just end up saying, and I kind of think this is the best case scenario, actually, is if they say, you know what, we're not even going to rule on anything right now, but none of this is going to happen. So you have to run on the maps that you already had in place. Because if we have a free-for-all where every state just gets to just come up with their own map, or some states can and other states can't, you're overturning the will of the people. Literally, they voted on this, and now a court is saying that's invalid. Like, this opens up a whole can of worms of unintended consequences. Again, I don't think that, you know, politicians should be choosing voters. Voters should choose politicians. I've always felt that way across the board. So I personally hope that, you know, the higher court intervenes. Mind you, there's not a lot of time left on their docket. They get out, I think, in June. You know, so logistically, just realistically, this needs to be resolved. And I think the only way to resolve this where the elections can happen the way that they should is if they just say, run it back the way you did it before. We'll deal with the new map question next time.
Yeah, I don't know what they do, right? Like, that's an option. But at this point, like, time's a ticking. And if you're in Virginia right now, not only do you not know your district, you don't even know if you're running as a Republican. Yeah. I mean, obviously, all the Republicans are out there. They're campaigning. Nobody knows the maps for sure, right? Like, it's all still moving forward. But I mean, dang, like, this is, we all knew that redistricting was going to be a bad idea, right? That this partisan gerrymandering fight we were getting into was going to be a food fight and going to be sloppy. We just thought that maybe the sloppiness would be a little bit sorted going into the actual election year.
Mm-hmm.
But not only is this hugely sloppy across the country, as each state does, you know, I'll figure out if they do or don't want to redraw their maps. I mean, you know, for a little while, J.B. Pritzker was saying like, oh, yeah, we'll look at it in Illinois, but you couldn't possibly gerrymander Illinois anymore. Like, you literally couldn't make that any worse. This makes it so much harder for Democrats for the midterms.
Yes, it does. Well,
it really does. And the money advantage for Republicans right now, if I'm Hakeem Jeffries, I'm going to try to raise as much money as I can right now off of this as an existential threat to the election for Democrats right now, because this is big for them.
Yeah, I mean, if things were to go 100% the Republican way, you know, we're talking about a net gain of 12 to 14 seats potentially here. Like, that is not insubstantial here. I do think that Republicans still face a tremendous amount of negative headwinds politically that they're going to have to overcome. But, you know, this is, again, this to me, this isn't democracy either. Like, you know, I do not like either party drawing lines the way that they are, this tit for tat that we have now. Well, you did this, so this state's going to do that. Now Florida's going to do that. And so, you know, South Carolina may do this. It's like, this is not how the process is supposed to work. And again, it is just creating chaos, uncertainty, which is not ingredients that we need right now, because there's enough questions about election integrity in America piling on this. Not great.
Yeah. And that's the thing, right? There's already an underlying question about election security and integrity in the United States. You couple that with changing district lines and uncertainty when it comes to who's running where and what districts sit where, and also the representation, right? I mean, we all remember high school civics class about how districts are meant to be drawn for an equal amount of representation in a geographical location. So that, you know, your neighbors who are going through the same water line issue or the same whatever public service works issue, you're all represented by the same person, so you can stand together and make your voice known. And now we, as a country, have just said, forget that.
Now
we don't even know what's going to happen with the midterms. That's the biggest thing, because Democrats already have a fundraising deficit. And you're right. They have historical headwind. They have historical wins at their back, and Republicans have headwinds they're going into. But if this does break Republicans' way, this would be absolutely one of the most historic midterms of.
Our history. I mean, it helps when you can rig the game ahead of time and go, okay, we're just going to do it this way, and only these people are going to be able to run.
This all breaks towards Republicans, that's not rigging the game. That would be the outcome of the judicial branch stepping in, right? The way it breaks is that there are court proceedings and litigation that follows. There's no rigging the game. You election denialism Democrat, would you knock that off?
I'm not an election denier.
It's like Democrats who are now trying to make a boogeyman out of election observers, where they're like, oh, they're going to send people to the polls now to watch you. Yeah.
Well,
people have been doing that.
If those observers
decades.
Are carrying firearms and federal badges and wearing masks,
not even the ICE argument. You know that's not what I'm talking about right now. Again, big bag boogeymans. Democrats don't want to argue the point, because when you have to, whoopsie poopsie, y'all get tripped up.
I'm not the one that's running around as a party saying, you know, Donald Trump didn't not lose the 2020 election. We talk about election denialism.
I'm not saying that.
I'm not saying you.
I didn't say you.
I'm saying your party has literally made a litmus test on who won the 2020 election. So if we're talking about election denialism, your party is exhibit A, B, and C.
You're undermining election integrity going into the next election when you do this. So for Democrats to sit here and do this yet again, you guys are undermining mail-in voting.
For crying out loud. Like, you guys are undermining the very thing that tactically you had the advantage on for so long. I'm old enough to remember, as a former Republican campaign operative, how the mail-in ballot was what we counted on to win some of these close elections.
Yes,
and
but
we
you
did.
Also know the propensity of voters in the electorate has changed. So trying to talk about mail-in ballots from 20 years ago is looking at a completely different Republican and Democrat electorate.
You guys are the party of looking back. You want to make America great again. But I am also of the mindset,
and you know this, you play by the rules of the road you're given. Like, you change the policy. You can't complain about it.
Yes,
right, as Republicans. No, I'm saying we can't complain about mail-in balloting and mail-in voting. If that's the law of the state, then you play by the law of the state and you play to win. And then when you win, you can change the laws. And that's like what representation equals. But don't call me an election denialism person when I'm the one over here spitting facts. And you, my good friend, are sitting on the other side trying to undermine election integrity with unfounded conspiracy theories.
It's not an unfounded conspiracy theory.
You started it. Dude, you started it when you were like, when Republicans rig the election. You started this.
I think when you deliberately draw lines, I'm going to start doing all the cartoon noise because you're going to lose. I think when you start drawing the lines this way, which Republicans are the
Democrats are doing it too.
No, they're not. Where are they doing it? Where are they doing it where it's going to actually happen?
Oh, I'm sorry that you guys can't get it done. That's not Republicans' fault. California. Don't whataboutism me, buddy. You guys
Texas,
are just as bad.
Florida, I don't know.
Florida hasn't. Know. Florida, you know, listen,
Ron DeSantis,
you and I both agree. You and I both agree that's not the thing that we should be doing. But don't sit here and say that Republicans are rigging the game when you're doing
it too.
And if the courts, through litigation, rule for Republicans, that is how our country
works. Look how big your Atlanta Braves eyes are right there. He knows the rigging.
I know, my bloops. Let me give him a little boop.
Big eyes. All right, we're going to move on to a more mature topic. Spencer Press.
You brought Blooper up, too.
He just agrees with me. I can see it in his eyes.
Let's talk about my favorite thing.
You've actually become obsessed with this.
Not obsessed. But I very much enjoy it.
All the time talking about this.
Well, not only this. I regularly talk about the Buffalo Bills, Britney Spears.
Things that
Britney,
you are obsessed with for 500.
I keep my diversity of thought. Yeah, I love Spencer Pratt and his campaign. I think he's doing a great job. Listen, and you and I kind of talked about this before we kicked off the podcast today, but I think that reality TV stars can make very good candidates. I think that this can actually work. And it's not even like the Ronald Reagan, Donald Trump celebrity of it all. Because, yeah, we've seen celebrities, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger,
sure.
The Undertaker,
Jesse Ventura. Okay, hold on. Pause. Aaron.
Wasn't he a mayor?
You're talking about his brother storyline, brother Kane, who is Glenn Jacobs, the mayor in Tennessee.
Yes. Okay. Wrestling people. You know what I mean.
I did News Nation with them actually 2 weeks ago.
Lots of celebrities who have become elected officials, but not a lot of reality TV people. And the reason why this kind of works for Spencer, just that alone, one, he's used to being authentic. He knows how to be himself in front of a camera. He knows how to talk to people. He's done tons of red carpets, tons of interviews. Mm-hmm. He's also really battle tested because he was America's villain in that era for a while.
But he was pretty appalling how he treated Heidi. Let's just be honest.
In those Hills days, this was completely different. But also, you don't need to do oppo research, really, and a vulnerability study. Like, everything's out there. Unless there's something really nefarious behind the scenes on a candidate, they've lived their life so publicly. You don't have to ask the question about what were you doing in your 20s, Spencer Pratt. You can rewatch The Hills, unlike Karen Commie Bass, who was in Cuba working with revolutionaries, right? Like, we can compare
Karen
20 years.
Karen Commie Bass.
Mm-hmm. Check them receipts. But I can tell you this. He does a great job on the debate stage.
Yes.
He is effective.
He did better on that. I got to say, I talked to a lot of people. I came up in California politics on both sides of the aisle here, who came away from that debate they had the other night. Actually, like, he came off a lot more poised, versed on the issues. It was not what they expected. He
was great.
Is one of the only people who has exceeded expectations on a debate stage in California.
He was great. And one of the lines I really loved was, at one point, what's her name? There's Bass and what's the other candidate's
name? Oh, this councilwoman, Rom. I know who you are.
Yeah, we're really on.
She ain't
going to
win. She's not going to win,
She was sitting there saying, like, this is what they're going to do. They're going to attack me because I'm the one they don't want to run against. And Spencer Pratt's response was, because they're like, when you name them, you get a 30-second rebuttal. And he was like, I'd like to go first. No one is going to believe that I am working with Karen Bass. Like, she burned down my house. I think she burned down my parents' house and my neighbors and my friends. There's no one that's going to believe I'm working with Karen Bass. So I would rather go against you, the terrible council member. Or, like, I'd rather go against Karen Bass, the terrible mayor, who, like it or love it, at least she's like, I can run against her record. Like, you're a terrible council member. I can run against either of you. He's like, I'm not doing this, like, teaming up with Terry. He's just so prepared in his answers. And I think what we have actually seen out of Republican debates and these jungle primary debates in California is everybody on the debate stage early, which I've enjoyed in this campaign season. But also, the Republicans have overperformed every time in these. And so that jungle primary, I think Steve Hilton's done really well in his debates at the gubernatorial level. And I think that Spencer Pratt's done a great job with these jungle primaries. When you give the oxygen and you give that opportunity on a debate stage, you could see these Republicans make it and maybe even win. And I think Spencer Pratt, he's running the kind of campaign that's political lightning in a bottle that could absolutely, he could win. He's got to bring in the money. He's got to get a ground game going. There are obviously political things he needs to be doing to shore up the campaign. But message-wise, consistency.
Oh, Aaron, you're adorable. Spencer,
you love him, you know.
Spencer has exceeded expectation. I'm going to give him that. I believe that he's just a flash in the pan, one-hit wonder. I think that when we get past the primary you know, that's when the clock strikes midnight and political reality just sets in L.A. We're talking about here where Republican registration is, you know, non-existent. I think he has.
But I think that's missing the point of what he represents, though. Right. Because he's still pulling out there and and you and I have talked about this before, is that his hardest thing will be that he is a Republican running in L.A.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
He should have run as an independent, honestly.
Is a political anomaly, though, that he is as a candidate. It gives, you know, you pointed out an article in our prep about him saying, like, maybe he'd be like a Barack Obama, but maybe he's like a Donald Trump. Maybe it is the political anomaly.
He would have been better off comparing himself to Trump or Jesse Ventura, actually, than to Barack Obama. I could tell you something, that right there. If he ends up making it here in a top two situation, him comparing himself to Barack Obama is like Democratic Party Harris. Like that is something that will motivate Democrats. That is something that will go like, how dare you compare yourself to Barack Obama?
I gotta tell you though,
if
the California LA election centers on Spencer Pratt's message of, these people are terrible. They burned our homes down and we want accountability and we need a government that does their job versus
most
he said
people
he's like Barack
and I'm
Obama.
Tell you something. Most
I can
people
tell
in
you,
the city of
I don't
LA
even think that's enough
to
motivate
about the
Democrats.
Hollywood Hills homes. They don't care about multimillionaires.
The homeless people that he's talking about, too. They care about the drug use they see on their streets. They care that L.A. County has seen the largest net out migration in the country. They care about all of that. And he's talking about all of that. He is. So, like, love him or lump him, don't underestimate him. Don't underestimate
him.
This is the political anomaly type of candidate.
And his potency as a messenger. But I just think that, like, realistically, again, I think that he is having his moment. I think that right now, at this second, this is as good as it's ever going to be for him. And he will have nowhere to go but down. And it will be once it gets real, once the primary is over, like, that's when you got to come back down to earth. And I think he's just going to get shellacked.
I disagree with that just because I think the quality of the candidate here makes a difference. And having run a lot of campaigns and seen a lot of bad candidates, seeing a good one, it makes your political heart a flutter a little.
Okay, we'll see. Well, I don't think
also,
he has staying power.
I will
power,
say this.
I could be wrong.
To close it out, he's not the only reality TV star running this cycle. Luke Gumbelson, who was a member of the show Summer House on Bravo TV, is running in Minnesota. I think you're going to see more of these style candidates kind of coming out of the reality TV sphere to say, like, I got nothing to hide. Let's go.
Oh, I just can't wait to see Shep one day run for something in South Carolina.
But anyway. No way. We all saw Thomas Ravenel.
Oh my God. He
not someone who should run.
Obviously he won't raise your taxes, okay, but he will raise the roof. That was one of his ads.
I remember it was live on the boat. Like, Oh God. Okay. So the next big thing isn't going to be the LA conversation. It's going to be 2028.
Yeah. We're like already into it. And it's interesting because there's just constant
We don't know the maps for 2026, but we are in the thick of it.
We're jumping ahead to 2028. Well, there's intrigue on the Republican side there. You know, our friends over at Kalshi, their latest has, you know, kind of interesting when you look at the 6 month trajectory of this. In the last 6 months, JD Vance has dropped 15% in the prediction markets. He's still leading, but he's dropped 15 points while Marco Rubio's up plus 19. And more recently, Tucker Carlson's kind of come on the scene too. You know, I have two questions for you. One, do you think is Tucker going to run for president? And then two, JD Marco, like it just Marco's meeting with the Pope this week, for crying out loud. Like he seems to be like having a moment here. Is this for real?
On the Tucker question, I don't know. Never say never in politics. You know, you just never know. It could happen. But if he who knows? But
should he run? How about that? Not will he?
No.
Should he? Okay.
No, because I don't think that that's like a... I wouldn't want... He's not someone I would want to be the party nominee. But okay. That doesn't, you know, that doesn't mean anything really, but that's just my personal.
So you're okay with Spencer Pratt being mayor of LA, but not Tucker Carlson being the Republican nominee for president?
Yes, I'm just okay to reconcile with Spencer Pratt being mayor of LA. I'm not saying I'm not comfortable with Tucker Carlson being president of the United States. It's just that's not the candidate I would probably be working for first.
Sure, sure. Okay. All right. JD Marco, what's going on here?
Yeah, I think that for them, a lot of this centers around foreign policy right now. And the foreign policy conversation being that JD so represented that non-interventionist, isolationist, rejection of neoconservatism wing of the party. And in a lot of ways, as much as, you know, Trump is kind of swatted away about who the MAGA heir apparent is, it would be JD. It is the Trump-Vance administration. And so, you know, there has been some reporting that JD hasn't felt comfortable with the Iran stuff and that he was, you know, had reservations behind the scenes. And so that little bit of that nod there, as you've heard a lot of consternation about Iran, even in the Republican Party, you know, there was heckling at a TPUSA event.
Yeah.
As he talked about foreign policy, but he has to own the Trump foreign policy because he's in it. It's not a fair comparison, but it's because JD is better at this than Kamala was, but Kamala carried the Biden administration with her, right? Yep.
Vice presidents but carry the weight Rubio, of their president. There's no other way around it.
Yeah, but for Rubio, you've seen him move up in the Kelce predictive markets. You've also seen him at one point surpass JD for a moment in the predictive markets as to who the nominee would be. And that's because what do you see out of him? You saw the White House press briefing out of him, where I think he gave one of the best answers I've ever heard on American exceptionalism and who we are as a nation. Mm-hmm. If you haven't seen it, look it up. Just do Marco Rubio press briefing. It'll come up.
Yeah, he did really well at that, actually. I can attest to that.
Yeah. Couple that with the trip to go see the Pope and the continued Iran negotiations. I mean, this is a guy who's in the middle of it without having to have his name tied to the front of it. So if things go well with Iran, if, you know, everything, you know, they get the ceasefire, things go. Marco, I think it's more the upside on that.
Yes.
He's been a bit more of the forward face on that. If things don't go well, JD does get kind of, I think, some of the downside of that. Because even if he goes on to a debate stage, and this is just tea leaves way down the road, let's pretend in a moment here. If he's on a debate stage and he gets the Kamala View question, like, what do you disagree with the president about? He can't really say anything the way she could. Now, she could have done a much better job with that answer. And like, that's a whole separate thing.
You think?
But like, he can't be honest about if this Iran reporting is correct, right? Mm-hmm. That's not something he can distance himself from the president on. So like, he's kind of in a politically really hard situation. And I know one more point here is that Secretary Rubio said he's not running if JD is running, if Vice President Vance is running. Everybody's a no in politics until they're a yes. So
I think that Rubio is in a better position politically because he doesn't have to carry the same political baggage that vice presidents do. Secretary of State's, you have a very specific, you know, job description there.
Unless you're Marco Rubio and you have 17 jobs in this administration.
That's true. But it's like that also speaks to like he gets to touch. He has so many touch points across, you know, in his sphere of influence is vast, but it's also not as public, ironically enough. Whereas the vice president, again, your job is to be one of the visible faces promoting, selling the agenda, whatever that might be, and serving at the pleasure of the president. So it's like, Vance, you're going to get all the baggage and none of the credit, because you're right. If it goes well, with a resolution in Iran, the Secretary of State gets the victory lap for that. Like, he's the one that's meeting with the world leaders. He's the one that's negotiating. He's the one that is... the becomes one of the public faces of the foreign policy, and you know Rubio is incredibly skilled. It's like, I know I have plenty to say about him that I disagree with, but I can also look at it and go, that performance at the briefing room was probably the best performance in that briefing room that I've seen during Trump 2.0 period from anyone.
I think that's not fair. I think Caroline does a very good job.
No, I don't mean that as a knock on her. I just mean anyone, like anyone who goes up there, whether it's the vice president.
Yeah, it's not easy.
Like, it is not an easy thing to do. I'm excluding staff from this.
I was going to say, like, that's not fair. I think Caroline does.
That was not a knock on the press right. I was just like, you know, when you get, when you step in, whether you were the former head of ICE or the Secretary of Homeland Security or whatever, anyone who's had to do this throughout the last, year and a half or so, like Rubio, I think was by far the best.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And so, and that's the thing. Predictive markets don't tell you how elections are going to end, but they can show you things a little bit earlier. And I think that's what people are starting to see a little bit in this Republican early wait to, it's like the end of March Madness and they put up their bracket for next year mm-hmm. of how they think the way too early, preseason stuff. But it's starting, now is starting to shape what you're going to see in 28.
Well, it's not logging. In the last 6 months, JD's down double digits, and Marco's rising double digits. So we'll see. The other market that I caught, just because, again, I'm in Texas here, was that Ken Paxton just hit his high, 60% of winning the primary against Cornyn. And this gets to the point now where even if, and it's not going to happen, even if Trump endorsed Cornyn, I don't know if that would move the needle enough. I think that Paxton's got this thing pretty sewn up. Which is pretty remarkable when you talk about the long career John Cornyn's had.
It really is. And it's really remarkable when you consider that he was almost Senate Majority Leader.
Yeah.
Right. When you look back mm-hmm. at Cornyn's time, the reason he wasn't was because of term limits. That's not to say that John Thune wouldn't have put up a race and couldn't have won it. But the reason that Cornyn fell out of leadership was he got term limited out as whip. And so mm-hmm. Thune moved into that seat. And so he was the number two under McConnell when McConnell retired. So he had a little bit more of that, even though Cornyn already had that. Anyways, all that aside, right? Like, that is a huge career change.
Yeah.
It's also a change, and it shows really even now how hardcore that base is for Trump, just for the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look at Indiana, too. I know that's not the same as the predictive market and looking at Texas and what they think, like, for Paxton's ability to win this, but it does speak really specifically to the fact that that base, the Republican base, the MAGA base, is still firmly Trump's. It is still firmly Trump. We saw it in Indiana with those elections, taking all of those people out who didn't vote against redistricting.
I think all but one survived.
Right. They just didn't do the redistricting that Trump wanted. And so he went after them politically and took almost all of them out.
It was a pretty big flex in Indiana.
And that is the base. And it's the same thing you're seeing right now, I think, a little bit in Texas, is to see a base that's saying, we want someone who's going to be with Trump. We know Paxton has had Trump's back. We know that Paxton is a fighter here. We know that he hasn't gone soft on any of the issues that we're looking at. So I think that's a bit reflective of what you're seeing here. But never count. These are really tough races. John Cornyn is an institution. Big John is a thing in Texas.
Yeah.
But it's to say that I think it's really reflective of where the Republican base is right now. And for people who are wondering what comes after Trump, what comes next, the base doesn't know either. And it's showing that right now by its really instinctiveness to stay exactly where Trump is.
Yeah. Yeah. I do think there's also a little bit of a generational thing happening. Turning the page from those who've been in office for a really long time, like Cornyn, to a younger, perceived, more dynamic personality in Paxton. I think the same thing's happening a lot of times in Democrat politics, too. We've seen, again, a lot of the old guard just kind of, not that they did anything perceived to be wrong or contrary to their party's values. There's an appetite for the electorate to just change the channel a little bit. It's why, again, I think that this election, like the last couple have been, it's a change election. So if you're an incumbent anywhere, whatever party you have, like you're in trouble because the electorate is just, they're kind of over it.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that part of it is also the change of it all and another change election. And yeah, but we shall see. That one's coming up soon, though.
Yeah, that's coming up here in a couple of weeks. And May, I think, is when the primary is officially the runoff there with Cornyn and Paxton happens. So it's good news for Tallarico. He's just coasting. He's just raising money.
Barnstorming
the state.
He's a good fundraiser.
Man, he's raising a lot of money. I'll say that. And no one's laying the glove on him right now.
Well, that's just because
too busy
as soon as,
each
I mean,
other up.
The good news. But here's the thing that Texas does well. These primaries are early.
Yeah.
So we're talking about June right now when they're going to switch into general election mode.
Yeah, they'll have 4 or 5 months to do what they want to do.
Yeah, you know what I mean? That's a lot of airtime and a lot of conversation time with voters. So he might be getting a little bit of a reprieve now, but Texas has a nice long general election runway where a lot of states don't. You look up in New England, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, those are end August, September primaries, later on the calendar. So
we'll see.
We'll see. All right, Kurt, that's it for me. What do you think?
I'm just looking forward. It's the weekend, so I'm going to chill.
Well, and it's Mother's Day weekend, so give your wife my best.
Oh, yeah. It is Mother's Day on Sunday. We should probably do something for her. Hmm.
Oh, my. I really...
I know what it is. Okay, you want to know what I'm doing? I'm going to... Okay. Don't tell her. The kids... You know those masks that you can get that, like, laser your face or whatever? Like,
oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. One of those red light masks?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that's
oh, that's a
gift.
Good one.
Yeah.
That's a good one. Oh, all right. Well done. Well done.
Kids just want to see her walk around the house wearing that thing, I think, just because I think it's funny.
Well, listen, she's going to love it, though. Her skin's going to be like, oh.
That's what we're doing over here at Casa de Bardella.
Love it. All right, friend. Well, we'll see you next week.
See you Monday.